Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, August 12th, 2015. Investigative reporter Jason Leopold lit the match, and CIA Director John Brennan's pants are on fire. Now, by profession, spies, spooks, intelligence bosses, whatever label you'd like to apply, they are professional liars. They keep secrets, and when they are asked, they defend, they dissemble, they try to distract you, and ultimately, they will lie. The proof we have in public is James Clapper, who is the top spook in the United States, the director of national intelligence, and he publicly perjured himself before a Senate committee about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. And now Jason Leopold, because the CIA claims it mistakenly released a document in a stack of files that were provided under the Freedom of Information Act, Jason Leopold has the evidence that John Brennan was covering up for CIA staffers who did, in fact, violate the agreement with Dianne Feinstein and the Senate Intelligence Committee and may have broken the law when the CIA people spied on the Senate people. Now, this produced what I believed was a potential constitutional crisis as two branches of government clashed, the Congress trying to exercise its role of oversight of the executive branch and the CIA, and the CIA trying to protect its secrets about torture. And all this revolves around the so-called Panetta Review. And Leopold and I have talked about this on many occasions. If you go to the search window at peterbcollins.com and enter Jason Leopold, you'll see a group of podcasts related to these issues. And I give Leopold a whole lot of credit. He is persistent. He's resourceful. He's got a great attorney named Jeffrey Light, who I've had the opportunity to talk to a couple of times. And Light files these lawsuits to force the disgorgement of documents under the Freedom of Information Act. And it is curious that the CIA, which considers itself so expert in the arts of spycraft, would screw it up, and in a dump of hundreds of pages of documents include a smoking gun letter. I'm going to link to the lengthy article that Jason Leopold has published just today at Vice News. It's a must read. And he walks us through the sequence of events as the Senate investigators, working in a secured facility under the scrutiny of CIA officers, used a Google search tool that was installed into this secure system. It's not on the internet. It's an intranet. And so one of the Senate staffers apparently entered a search term related to the Panetta Review, and it popped up. And the CIA did not expect that, and they moved into damage control and cover-up mode. And while John Brennan dragged his feet, refused to answer questions, pointed ones that were supplied in letters from both Senator Feinstein and Saxby Chambliss, who was her ranking Republican member at the time in the Intelligence Committee, he stonewalled them for a year. And then the letter that was accidentally released was a draft letter that John Brennan never signed, and it included an admission of wrongdoing and an apology. And it was based on his own Inspector General, David Buckley, who said, well, you know, I did the investigation, and CIA staff improperly accessed the shared drive when conducting a search for CIA privileged documents. So Brennan drafted this letter, and you can see it at Vice News. where he admits they did it and apologizes. But he never signed or sent that letter. And he continued to stonewall. He put a group of cronies together, led by former Indiana Senator Evan Bayh, an intelligence community apologist from way back. And he wrote the whitewash reports. No big deal here. No. Just keep moving. And, of course, the former Attorney General Eric Holder was asked by both the CIA and by the Senate to investigate this, and he declined. As you may know, I hold Eric Holder in a pretty low regard. But this, I think, is a real cowardly action. The Attorney General, I think, was duty-bound to investigate this dispute between the CIA and the Senate. It has serious constitutional implications. And we know that Holder made his decision to decline to investigate even before the initial inspector's general reports were delivered to him. And so turning a blind eye to this is just enabling this kind of double-dealing, dissembling, duplicity, yes, and downright lies. Jason Leopold has told me he's taking a couple of days off, but he's agreed to record an interview for our podcast this coming Monday, and I will be excited to share that with you early next week. Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Light, Leopold and Light, that has a nice ring to it, doesn't it? Well, they are also responsible for the pressure that has produced the batches of Hillary Clinton's emails that are being released by the State Department as they are reviewed. And this whole episode has taken a new twist as the former Secretary of State has directed her people to give the Justice Department the email server that housed that personal account that she used while she was Secretary of State. They have been looking for the server and a thumb drive that we're told contains the official emails, but not her personal emails. We're told those have all been deleted and cannot be recovered. But the thumb drive has been held by her criminal defense attorney, David Kendall, and she has told him to cough that up to the FBI. And the reason is that at least two of only 40 of the emails that were reviewed by inspectors general were found to be classified at the time that they were sent and received. And this sets up the prospect that Hillary has publicly lied about this, because in July, at a public event in Iowa, she said, "I'm confident that I never sent or received any information that was classified at the time it was sent and received." Now, to be fair to Hillary, some of this material is being retroactively classified as it is being reviewed by the State Department for release. And I can't in any way blame her for that. But in this convoluted effort, Hillary publicly stated she was allergic to email, after all of the scandals and investigations while she was first lady. And so she's never said exactly what her intention was. She said, she only wanted to carry one device, but she carries more than one device. And so I do conclude that this was an effort to dodge accountability and release of her emails. And it has caught up with her, and I think it is going to linger. It's not simply a gotcha game as part of the Benghazi investigation run by Trey Gowdy. But I think it does have very serious implications and can stall out the Clinton campaign. Now, based on these same emails, our friend and colleague Steve Horn, the intrepid reporter at DSmog blog, has put together a fascinating pattern of behavior related to Hillary's tenure at the State Department, and how her top assistants worked to break the lock that the Pemex oil company, the state-owned oil company of Mexico, has had on the energy sector in that country, and to promote fracking and American companies to break into the Mexican market, which they've been locked out of ever since Pemex was formed, 60, 80 years ago. So what Steve Horn does using these emails is puts together the connections between Hillary Clinton and her international energy coordinator, a guy named David Goldwyn, who now is a consultant, an attorney, and he works at the industry-funded Atlantic Council. And the emails show that he used a private email address for some of his communications. But Goldwyn was a point man, and he was succeeded by a guy named Carlos Pascual, who was the ambassador to Mexico before he joined Hillary's State Department, to be the second one to serve as international energy coordinator. And the third person who Steve Horn connects to Hillary Clinton through her emails is a man named Brown. His name is Neil Brown. He used to work for U.S. Senator Richard Lugar, the Republican from Indiana. And now he works with David Petraeus at the Kohlberg-Kravis-Roberts Global Institute. And Steve Horn connects the dots in some fascinating ways. Here is an excerpt from my conversation with Steve Horn.
So this is this whole thing that happened starting with the Clinton administration and David Goldwyn, who was her first choice as an international energy coordinator, is under her watch, under her State Department's watch, she started something called the Global Shale Gas Initiative, which was still exists. It's now called the Unconventional Gas Technical Engagement Program, but does the same thing. The whole purpose of the program is use State Department resources to go around the world and bring people from the U.S. oil and gas industry and teach best practices for fracking, as they call it, as a means to hopefully open up emerging markets for fracking around the world. And so this is the role that Goldwyn played. There's an article, a previous article to mine, that was about him and mostly Eastern Europe that Mother Jones published, called How Hillary Clinton Sold Fracking Around the World. Mm-hmm. And so my story really focused on how Hillary Clinton's State Department and David Goldwyn, and then the person who came after him in that position, Carlos Pascual, who at the time Goldwyn was in that position, he was the U.S. ambassador to Mexico, how those two, and you know, under Hillary Clinton's State Department, played a pretty instrumental role in the constitutional reforms that were passed in Mexico's government in December 2013, which opened up, you know, privatized the oil and gas industry there, opened it up for other companies to join in joint ventures with Pemex or Petróleos Mexicanos.
You can hear the full conversation with Steve Horn. It's released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. And in addition to the emails from the State Department, he also gives us his idea of how Hillary might view the approval of the Keystone XL pipeline and other important environmental and energy issues if she is elected president. Also in our interview with Steve Horn, toward the end, we talk about an issue that he's been covering in Wisconsin related to presidential candidate and Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. And today, as I'm speaking on the 12th of August, Scott Walker is signing into law a $250 million state subsidy for the billionaire owners of the Milwaukee Bucks to build a new arena. And it is fraught with pay-for-play lobbyists. It is a bipartisan rape of the taxpayers of Wisconsin. And it's quite a story. So I hope you'll follow both of those threads in the podcast that I'm releasing today with Steve Horn. And I want to thank the people who support my work here at this podcast with your contributions and subscriptions. People like Dick Atlee, Cheryl Fleming, Faith People, she's got more than one subscription, and Anthony Abell just renewed his annual subscription. I invite you to join them and provide the validation and a little cash to keep this whole thing going. You can go to peterbcollins.com, click on the sign-up link right under my picture on the homepage. That takes you to the next page where you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month. You can make a one-time contribution. You can mail in a check or a money order or cash if you don't like PayPal. I understand that. Or our best deal is the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers earn the bonus gift. It's Pepe Escobar's ebook called Empire of Chaos. Well, Facebook is an interesting portal. And today I was amused by two adjacent posts, one right after the other. The first one headlined, "The Bernie Sanders Surge Appears to Be Over." and the number crunchers at natesilvers538.com. Take a look at the patterns over the last few months, and I do think they have a point that you can only surge so much. And as you become better known and people decide whether they support you or not, the gains that you can make decline. Now, that part is fair enough. But, as I say, adjacent to this headline, the Sanders surge appears to be over, is the news from New Hampshire. Poll: Bernie Sanders surges ahead of Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire, 44-37. Now, there's a pretty big margin of error on this poll. I think it's 5 or 6 points. So don't take it literally. And also, none of these polls really offer us more than a snapshot of the moment. Commentators have noted in the past few days that Joe Lieberman was the front runner for a while in 2000. And you're saying, Joe who? And Rudy Giuliani was a front runner for the Republicans at this stage of the 2008 campaign. Also in New Hampshire, Joe Biden got 9%. Former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, Lincoln Chafee, the former governor of Rhode Island, and former Governor Jim Webb of Virginia barely register at 1%. And with that big margin of error, that means they are no place. So that is the current snapshot, but it is amusing that Bernie's surge can be declared over and another surge hits in the next Facebook window. I was a little surprised as I read the New York Times today. There are a few interesting things from the Times I'm going to refer to here. Tom Friedman, who has written at length about Israel and who is generally considered to be a supporter of the government of Israel, wrote a thoughtful op-ed where he tries to take the point of view of an Israeli grocer, then an Israeli general, and then the Israeli prime minister toward the nuclear deal with Iran. Now, he just basically says the Israeli grocer is quivering in fear and would reject the Iran deal. But he goes on to say, if I were an Israeli general, I would note that Israel has 100 to 200 nuclear weapons. It is not a disarmed Costa Rica. It has a history of being crazy and not letting people, as Friedman puts it, out-crazy them. Also, Israel tends to fight war without mercy and is willing to kill innocent civilians, who it considers to be in its way. Then he goes to Netanyahu, while never naming Bibi. He says, if I were Israel's prime minister, I'd start by admitting that my country faces two existential threats. One external is an Iranian bomb, and the other internal is the failure to separate from the West Bank Palestinians into two states. To deal with the Iran threat, I would not, as Israel's leader, be pressuring U.S. Jews to go against their own government to try to scuttle the deal, when I have no credible alternative. Friedman continues, this deal sharply reduces Iran's bomb-making uranium stockpile for 15 years. I'd be very confident that if I can keep Iran a year away from a bomb for 15 years, that during that time Israel's defense technologists will develop many more ways to detect and eliminate any kind of Iranian breakout. And, Friedman continues in the voice of Netanyahu, I'd recognize that if my lobbyists in Washington actually succeeded in getting Congress to scrap this deal, the result wouldn't be a better deal, it would be no deal. So Iran would remain 3 months from a bomb. Now, of course, I don't buy that notion that Iran is currently 3 months away from a bomb. But that is the widely accepted conventional fantasy myth. And I think that it's interesting how Friedman addresses that. Also in the New York Times today is an unusual article about an American Jewish journalist, Larry Kohler Esses, who writes for The Forward. And I've seen that online. It's a New York-based newspaper catering to American Jews. And this reporter, a couple of years ago, asked for an interview with the Iranian prime minister, and instead they said, well, why don't you get a visa and come to Iran? And so he did. He was given a week, and he was allowed to talk to anybody who wanted. He said they didn't constrain him in any way about what he asked or what they answered. And he writes, ordinary Iranians with whom I spoke have no interest at all in attacking Israel. Their concern is with their own sense of isolation and economic struggle. Then he talked to senior Ayatollahs and prominent officials. No one had anything warm to say about the Jewish state, but pressed as to whether it was Israel's policies or its very existence to which they objected, several were adamant it's Israel's policies. And he, while certainly couldn't have talked to a broad cross-section of the Iranian population, I think he punctures some of the, crazy balloons that are filled up with hot air from Israeli talking points. Well, there is an economic crisis originating in China that has hammered the stock market in the United States and elsewhere the last couple of days. And yesterday, China devalued its currency by about 2%, and today it took a second cut of about 1.6%. And some of this is historic, because the U.S. has long accused China of currency manipulation. And this appears to be responding to market forces, to the crash of the Chinese stock market over a month ago, the tightening of trading restrictions so that people who hold large blocks of stock have to freeze it for now. And the analysts, who certainly know much more about this than I do, say that this currency devaluation is a way to stimulate exports and to try to broaden the economy, to try to expand the interests of China in the international community. Nevertheless, this is an important issue to watch. And currencies are fluctuating wildly. The U.S. dollar in general is very strong right now, and yours truly is planning an overseas vacation during the month of September. You're the first to be tipped off about that, and I'm at least happy that the dollar is strong. But I have friends in Brazil who are being hammered because the dollar has almost doubled in value against the real. And, of course, they have their own political and economic crisis in Brazil right now related to the Petrobras scandal. One other quick economic note. My San Francisco Chronicle this past Sunday published a column by business writer Thomas Lee where he noted that there is $1.3 trillion in cash that is stashed offshores held by American-based companies that are non-financial. So this excludes the banks. It notes, for example, that Apple is the top tax evader with $155 billion in profits stashed offshore. Second is Google with about $64 billion. And then Cisco has $52 billion. Amazon is sitting on $17 billion in profits stashed offshore. And eBay is the piker here with only $6.3 billion offshore. And when you hear the Republican candidates talk about the need to lower the corporate tax rate, don't buy that. They don't pay taxes. They have all kinds of evasive games that they effectively use to keep that money offshore. And maybe you know that Apple has been paying dividends the last year or so, and they borrow money against their offshore profits to pay those dividends rather than pay American taxes and bring those earnings home. It's really disgusting and disgraceful. And while Obama did talk about doing something about it, we really haven't seen any action to try to limit this. Got some interesting email comments that I wanted to share with you, some related to economics. And our friend and listener, William Gruters, who lives in the Netherlands, says that we should keep an eye out. He says, austerity is coming to the U.S. soon. And he said that it followed rising interest rates in Europe. And that because the U.S. has had a record 35-year run with interest rates coming down after the inflation round in the 1970s, he argues that we should watch out. He said that with the Fed planning to raise interest rates later this year. They've been warning all the investor class about that. He said that the U.S. has current account deficits that have been running since 1990, and that austerity will be coming to the U.S. as well. He warns, just wait and see. And this other comment just tweaked my interest because the New York Times recently ran an editorial about how the Obama administration is a little fuzzy on what the biggest threats are to the United States. Is it Russia, as the military says? Is it the Islamic State and the roiled wars in the Middle East? And someone who identifies him or herself as Burroughs made this post as a reaction. While we calculate the various threats presented by Russia, China, ISIL, Al-Qaeda, Canada is preparing to release a massive cloud of soporific sanctimonious, which will leave all of the U.S. incapacitated. The Canadians will then walk down into the lower 48 and establish a millennium of peace and brotherhood after we have awakened. With our Canadian overlords in place, the United Provinces and States of Canada will establish world peace, universal joy, and a global hockey league. I got a kick out of that. Well, this is sobering. I watched some video footage shot in a suburb of Damascus yesterday that shows clear evidence of firebombing. And the Syrian military, loyal to the dictator Bashar al-Assad, has been accused of using napalm or something like it. And this would be the second serious allegation. Back in 2012, a BBC news crew in Aleppo province witnessed what they described as a napalm-like attack on a school. Now, this attack yesterday came almost exactly 2 years since the infamous sarin gas attack in the Damascus suburb of Ghouta that killed more than 1,000 people and led to this Obama red line about chemical weapons. We still don't know. Despite the assertions by the U.S. that it was the Assad government who did that, we don't know if that's true. And I have been doubtful. But Syrian civil defense volunteers say that they dropped 4 barrel bombs containing napalm Tuesday afternoon in the town of Daraya, triggering huge fires, which took hours to get under control. And one more reference to the New York Times. And by the way, I know some of my listeners think that the Times is unreliable, that it is a corporate outlet that delivers government-controlled propaganda. That's often the case. But it's our only real, credible national newspaper. And as a basis for my news and comment, I do rely heavily on the New York Times, and I often criticize it. And I also try to share with you information that the Times puts out because it is a kind of proof that the information has been shared with the thinking class in the United States. And so today I'm going to link to this. There is a Maps Plus text package in the New York Times. It's up on its website. Headlined, "Why is Turkey fighting the Kurds who are fighting ISIS?" And it notes that Kurdish fighters have been coordinating with the American military since last October in the attacks in northern Syria. The problem is that the Syrian Kurds, called the YPG, fight alongside the Turkish Kurds, called the PKK. And Turkey considers them an outlaw, a terrorist group. The U.S. designates the PKK as a terrorist group. So this has been an awkward alliance against the evildoers of the Islamic State. But when we apparently persuaded Turkey to enter the fray, Turkey did a couple of attacks on Islamic State positions and then turned most of its force on its own Kurdish population inside Turkey. And despite this possible trade-off where the U.S. is accepting Turkish support at the cost of abandoning the Kurds who've been the most effective fighters. We know the Iraqis can't do it. They haven't to date. And curiously, Brett McGurk, Obama's envoy to the coalition fighting the Islamic State, said, "We fully respect our ally Turkey's right to self-defense." Now, attacking the Kurds with airstrikes inside Turkey is hardly self-defense. This is a new civil war unleashed by the Erdogan government. And since the events in Suruk a couple of weeks ago, which a correspondent who was in the area described to me as having all of the elements of a false flag attack, I've been very skeptical about these developments. And later this week, I hope to conduct an interview with the correspondent that I've been referring to and get more information and share that with you here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. So thanks for joining me today. This is my news and comment podcast. It's delivered free every day, and you are free to share it with anybody in the world. I hope you put it up on Facebook, share it, and even click that little like button, okay? I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until